Now, our speaker today, we have Dr. Ariana Berardi-Wiltshire, who, as you can see, is from the School of Humanities, Media and Creative Communication. She has a BA from Mercy, postgrad diploma in second language teaching, and a PhD also from Mercy. Her primary area of research is heritage and minority language education and revitalization, with some of her recent studies looking at language maintenance efforts of New Zealand migrant families, from a family language policy perspective, and on learning Te Reo as a second language in the workplace. And there's other some international research things she's been doing as well. General areas of interest cover language learning motivation, identity and language learning, heritage languages, language revitalization, sociolinguistics, applied linguistics, second language acquisition. There's a lot of overlap with those, so it's not incredibly broad with that. However, I did find there are some interesting things that she's been doing. Now, going back over 10 years, there was a report coming out which she was very critical of, according to the Mercy website, with a press release, about a negative correlation between conditions favourable to English language acquisition and those that promote heritage language maintenance. In other words, it was almost as if the report was concluding, you know, the idea of trying to bring up bilingual children or whatever might not be so good. I strongly disagree with that, so I'm right behind you on that.
So did I.
Yeah, and I also saw more recently, she's talked, well, I found for a long time with texting, it was, I thought, I'm not going to do short thing, I'll spell out the words completely and put in the punctuation and so on. And I finally thought, no, I'm getting out of step with the younger generation, it's time for me to change. And she was there saying, expert reveals why we should use less text slang because the younger generation now think that's old-fashioned and they're not doing it anymore. So we can't win. Yeah, languages are always changing, and that's a major part of linguistics, so I'll hand over to our speaker to talk about that.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, everyone. It might take me a little while to get used to the microphone because I haven't used them in ages and ages. And I might stutter a little bit because I get terribly nervous speaking to groups, big groups of people. So just bear with me. I will relax in a minute. After the first couple of slides, I'm usually much, much better. But I can just like, just relax. So it's great to have you here. My name is Ariana, and I'm a linguist. And it sounds very much one of those AA introductions, right? Like, my name is Ariana, and I'm a linguist. Okay. It's not a bad thing to be a linguist. But the fact is, when I tell people that I'm a linguist, usually, without any doubt, they always ask me, oh, you're a linguist, so how many languages do you speak? And they're always terribly disappointed when I say that I only really speak two and a half. I mean, I'm not a polyglot, I'm a linguist. And so the second thing that they do is they get really nervous and they think that I'm going to check their grammar. So quite often they turn around and avoid me for the rest of the evening. You know, it's like, oh no, she's going to tell me off because I used a double negative or something. But the idea of linguistics is that it's basically the science of language. We look at language the way a doctor would look at the body. You can look at it in its different parts and the parts that make it up. You can look at it holistically. You can look at how it works and how it interacts with the surroundings. That's what a linguist do. And also the idea that people get so hung up on how many languages and the grammar part reveals something really interesting. It reveals that people take language for granted. Language is so much more than just grammar and many different languages. But because we use language every day so much, we are immersed in language all the time. We see language, speak language, sometimes thinking language, not all the time. It's like water to a fish. You kind of take it for granted. And so when you say you do the science of language, people are also a little bit doubtful. It's like, what is there to science about? I mean, if you don't speak 20 languages, you're not going to check my grammar. Well, what the heck do you do all day? And so today I'm going to try and see if I can solve the problem a little bit, and I can scratch the surface a little bit and show you that language is so much more complex and so much more fascinating than just what people normally think. And so I'm going to give you the linguist's perspective on language. And by the end of it, I hope to have raised your awareness a little bit and allowed you to learn a few things that will help you notice how language is rich and fascinating, and potentially also how language makes us who we are, and how language, looking at language, can reveal a lot of who we are as people and as humans, in fact. So we can get started. And throughout my many slides, because I always prepare way too much material and then I just kind of go until it's time to end, I have a few prompts, so I will ask you, I will turn to you and I will ask you to think about certain things or reflect on certain things, and I hope that you will be up to the challenge and chatty, and I'm happy to give my voice a little bit of a rest and let you express yourself a little bit. And then, of course, there will be questions at the end. But do stop me anytime if something can't wait. If something absolutely can't wait and you have to ask, just raise your hand and we'll go from there. Okay?
Cool. Right. All right.
So, when I said that linguistics is the science of language, as any sciences, there are different areas of linguistics, depending on what linguists look at. And so the two main parts of linguistics are microlinguistics and macrolinguistics. Microlinguistics is the part of linguistics that looks at language really, really, really close, like puts language under a microscope and looks at all the parts that make it up. All the little sounds and the little words and how words are put together to do sentences and all the secret bits and pieces that make language itself what it is. And then there is macrolinguistics. And macrolinguistics is more focused on how language works in various areas of people and of life. So today we are going to mostly talk about parts of linguistics and parts of language that have been looked at by microlinguists. So we are going to, and I don't know whether you can see the slide, but it doesn't really matter. I'll summarize it for you. We'll look at some elements of phonology, which is the sounds of language. We'll look at some elements of morphology and lexicon, which are the words. And we are going to look at some elements of semantics or meaning, and syntax, which is grammar. Scary, scary grammar. And we are going to duck out of microlinguistics a few times for the more kind of fascinating stuff, according to me, which is how people use language and how language works in the mind and between people. So that's the arena of sociolinguistics, so how language is used in society. Psycholinguistics and neurolinguistics, how language is stored and accessed in the brain. And then applied linguistics, whose focus is mostly on how languages are learned. First languages, second languages, and all the other ways that people can learn languages. Okay. So a little bit of microlinguistics and a little bit of macro for you, just so that you can sample a little bit of everything. We're going to start very, very, very small. We're going to start with a little bit of phonology. So obviously languages are made of sounds, right? So what's coming out of my mouth now is just a string of sounds. And languages were made of sound way longer than they have been made of written down words, alphabets, and symbols. language has existed for as long as humans have existed. So as little as 150,000 years ago to 300,000 years ago. And we've used language all the time. But it's only about 5,000 years ago that we started writing languages down. So writing is actually quite a recent invention. But language is primarily made of sound. And each language has its own sound system. So of all the sounds that you can make with these speech organs, and you can see the speech organs marked on the picture there. There's also another screen there. If you guys are closer and want to look at the screen next to you, that's a much better view for some of you. So the speech organs are in the lungs, of course. They provide the breath that animates your speech. And then the throat, the larynx, and the pharynx, they make the sounds, the primary sounds. And then we have the articulation speech organs, which are in your mouth, some of them in your throat, but in your mouth, your tongue being the primary one, but also your teeth, your lips, okay, and parts of your other parts of your mouth, like your palate and your uvula right at the back. We all have the same instrument, but depending on what language we speak, we only use a partial amount of the sounds that we can make at any time. And languages vary so greatly depending on how many sounds they include. Some languages have a very small sound repertoire. So some of the Pacific languages, for example, have very, very small sound repertoires. So Rotokas, for example, only has 11 sounds in total. 6 consonants and 5 vowels. That's very, very little system, a little system. And then on the other side, there is languages that are just massive in terms of sounds. So this one is Ho. It's an African language. Has 110 to 130 sounds. Honestly, there are so many that even phonologists kind of gave up at some stage. But basically they have something like 80 to 90 consonants and they have 30 plus vowels. So you can think of the vowels that you have in English, right? You can kind of like, not very many. Well, in that language, they have 30 different vowels. I'm like, how do they even make all of those sounds? Well, in the case of this particular language, or a lot of their consonants are actually clicks, and I just made a click right there, right? So think of all the clicks that you can make with your mouth, okay? So some of them are straight out, and you can make them with your tongue and your palate, so being one. You can make some with your teeth. You can make some with your lips. That's a bilabial click, right? That's a bilabial click. We are so much fun linguists, honestly. But you can make them straight out, and then you can make lateral ones with the side of your mouth. Okay, you can make them one side and the other. Then you can make clicks with your throat as well, like that. So this particular sound and many other clicking tongues have a huge variety of clicks. And then we have English. And English is kind of in the middle, right? It's not tiny, 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 but it's not huge like some languages. And English has 44 sounds in total. It has 24 consonants and 20 vowels. Yes, that's what I said. English has 24 consonants and 20 vowels. But it only has 26 letters. So what's going on there? The idea is that, and a linguist knows this, is that languages have secret sounds. Sounds that exist and that we speak every day, not a lot of people know about. So here's an example. Here's the sound T in English. You write it as the letter T. Okay? So those are all the different types of T sounds that are in use in English today. not just in New Zealand English, but in other types of English as well. So some of those types of T sound are only used in British English or American English and so on. But they are individual sounds that exist individually from one another. So we write them all down with T, but we say them differently. And the difference depends on what kind of regional variety of English we speak, but also what kind of sounds exist around that particular sound. Depending on the company it keeps, a sound might sound one way or sound the other way. They kind of adapt to the context. So, for example, the first symbol that you have up there in the first row is a T. It's a T symbol with a little H. That's called aspirated. That's an aspirated sound. That's an aspirated T. We make that every time we say a word. For example, say Tom. The word Tom, the name, the man, Tom. Can you hear a little puff of air after the T? Tom. Tom. Try and say it without the puff of air. You can't. You can't. Tom. I can't. Okay. So, whenever the T is followed by a stressed syllable at the beginning of the word, in particular in English, it has that little added secret sound after it. It's called an aspiration. Then there is a fairly normal T. It's unaspirated, no puff of air. And this happens normally after S. So what's a word with a T after an S? Stress. Stress. There's no puff of air there. Then we have the interesting kind of T's. This one is the one that you say if you're American and you say water. What do you say?
Water.
Water. So this little this little sound there, which is really difficult to isolate, it's called a flap, okay? And it's only used in some particular varieties of English. And then we have one that's really, really interesting, and it looks like, the symbol looks like a question mark without the dot, right? That's called a glottal stop. This is the kind of T that British people say when they say butter. You know? Yeah, butter. Or water. They say, the Americans say water, and the British say butter and water. Yes? So that it's glottal, it's in your mouth, it's in your throat. And then you have a number of them. And that's just the T. Now, pretty much all the other consonants in English have some variations depending on, again, regional dialect or where that sound features in a word. These are called allophones. So the T, the kind of universal T sound, the one that you write down, is a phoneme. And they usually correspond to a letter. But then you have the swag of allophones. And allophones, you can't see them written down unless you use a very specific alphabet. And it's an alphabet that linguists have come up to capture all of that tiny detail in the way people articulate sounds in a way that the alphabet, the written language, cannot capture. And this alphabet is called the IPA alphabet. And as you can see from the example that you have there, what that strange word with A, I, with a little curvy thing at the bottom, and then the P with the H, and that's how you write IPA in IPA alphabet. Can you kind of see? So linguists really needed a universal alphabet that they could have when they went out into the world, and they were sent to study languages that no one had ever heard before, and these languages were so different from the languages that they knew, like the clicking languages, for example. And they were met with this challenge, it's like, well, how do I write this language down? I have no symbol for a click. What do I do? And so they came up with this alphabet, which is called the IPA alphabet. And you find the IPA alphabet when you look for how words need to be pronounced. So if you go to Wikipedia and you look for something fairly unfamiliar, something that's not well known, quite often you will have the IPA pronunciation guide afterwards. And if you were someone who knew the IPA alphabet, you would be able to pronounce that just by reading the word in the IPA. So a well-trained phonologist will be able to look at any word spelled out in IPA and pronounce it straight away, just like it was normal English. So these are all little details that phonologists take care of. But phonologists are not just interested in little tiny details of sounds and describing them and decoding them and documenting them. Learning the details of language sounds is also useful because then you can start to see patterns. It's not just isolated little beans of sounds. You start to see patterns of how they are systematized together, how they come into strings. They are not chaotic. They have systems and patterns, and each language has its own little system. But also knowing about the sounds tells you about how we make the sounds. It tells you something about the fascinating skills that we have in articulating those sounds. Never mind that we need to learn all the sounds of our first language, but then we have to articulate them, and then we have to remember them, and then we have to use them appropriately. That's a huge amount of skill that we have. So you actually, when you articulate words, when you use language, you do stuff that you don't even know that you're doing. Okay, I'm going to tell you some of the secret stuff that you do. So your mouth does secret math. Okay, did you know that? So for example, English has two different types of sound, the S, right? One is called voiced, and it's zzz. And it's called voiced because while you do it, your vocal cords are vibrating. Zzz. And then there is a sister, which is unvoiced or devoiced, and it's zzz. Can you hear the difference? You do it. Do the voiced one. And do the voiceless. Can you hear the difference? If you put your hand on your throat with the voiced, you can hear your throat vibrating. And with the voiceless, it doesn't vibrate. Now, you might not know this, but depending on where that S appears in the string of words that you're saying, your mouth knows whether to make it voiced or voiceless. So if you say cats, for example, your mouth knows that the S at the end of cat is voiceless. Cats. But if you say dogs, that S is voiced. Now, no one taught you that. No one ever taught you that, but we do it all the time. We also insert little secret vowel sounds here and there that we don't actually write down. So if you say horses, okay, horses, this is at this before the final S, there is orsis, but it's not an E, it's actually an I. In English does this thing where it inserts secret sounds in particular places in words. One of these sounds, the most famous of it, is this one. It's called a schwa. And schwa is a little vowel sound that it's not A, I, E. It's none of them. It's done with the mouth open, and it's a free sound. So it sounds like It sounds a bit French. Okay? It's not high like an E, and it's not low like an ah. It's like the middle. And it's not written down. We don't write down the schwa anywhere, but it's everywhere. Okay? So English automatically inserts the schwa in the middle between consonant clusters, and English is really good at consonant clusters. Okay? to make them easier to pronounce. So you try and say rhythm. Rhythm. Can you hear the schwa? Rhythm. There's a little before, between the T and the N. Rhythm. Another one is every. Every. You can say every, but it's actually every. Can you hear the schwa? Okay, that's schwa. And there's a little joke among linguists that the schwa is never stressed. It's never stressed because it's kind of secret and it kind of inserts itself in unstressed vowels. So we always say, I want to be a schwa because the schwa is never stressed. Anyway, so that's the story of the schwa. So no one ever taught you these tricks. You know, many of you didn't even know that the schwa existed, but you've said many, many, many trillions of schwas in your lifetime as a speaker of English. And that's because our brains are amazing. Not only our brains are amazing, but babies' brains are even, you know, more amazing than yours or mine or any kind of brain. In fact, when we are born as infant, our brains can hear all of the sounds that the human voice can make. Babies can hear and have the potential to articulate when they get a little bit older. Over 800 sounds, over 800 phonemes. They hear all the detail, and their brain is programmed by the people that they interact with to limit that range over the first year of life until when babies reach 1 year of age, their ears and their brain are tuned to one language only, their mother tongue. And then from there on, they really focus on that. Now, if babies are exposed to more than one language during that time in their childhood, they can learn more than one language. But if they're only exposed to one language, they really focus on that. So after 1 year of age, some of the sounds of other languages around there, we have a lot of trouble hearing them. And we would have a lot of trouble articulating them. So we all have the same instrument, musical instrument here, but after 1 year of age, it becomes tuned a particular way. And once it's tuned, it's really difficult to untune it or tune it differently, right? And if you try, chances are you end up with an accent, a foreign accent, like my foreign accent. My brain was tuned to my mother tongue. I won't say what it is. Maybe you can guess. But then I learned English later in life. And so I tried to retune my instrument. And it has kind of worked. But some of the sounds I could never get exactly right. And you can tell, right? You can tell. So where do you think I come from? What do you think was my first language? Yeah, who said that? Italy. Yeah, very good. Did you notice or did you... Right, okay. Good. How do you know? What sounds did I make?
Gelato.
What's that?
I've eaten gelato.
You've eaten gelato. So your tongue knows the taste of Italy. Yes, that's fantastic.
I think it's the A sound. The A?
The A? So a vowel sound. So you think it's a vowel sound? Any other sounds that give me away? So there's a sound, so the TH in Italy, the th sound, okay, we don't have that in Italy. We don't have that type of T, th. It just doesn't exist. For us, it's all a hard T, T, or a D, which is also kind of a T. So it's T or D. So what I tend to do, without knowing, is I tend to approximate, I tend to simplify the TH sound, the, to the. And you hear that. You might not be able to articulate it, but when I say them, I actually say them. That's a very Italian thing to do. Very, very Italian thing to do. Now, how many of you raise your hand? We are raised not in English, with a different mother tongue. Oh, very good. Okay, so quite a few. So what language is your mother tongue? People that have raised your hand, just shout it out.
Dutch.
Anybody else?
Cantonese, Chinese.
Okay, and?
Portuguese.
Okay, so what are the sounds of English that give you the most trouble, if you have some sounds that give you the most trouble. So for Dutch, do you have any particular difficulties?
I do the same as you.
The TH.
Yeah.
And Dutch doesn't have the th sound, so it's the same. So do you fall onto D?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So for Cantonese, what are the sounds of English that give you the most trouble?
The TH.
The TH as well. So how do you say TH? Like a D? Th. Like a, more like a T. Right. Okay. Good. So that he, did you hear the articulation? That was like super awareness of articulation there. That's. And Portuguese. Do you have what sounds in English give you the most trouble?
If I notice my vowels, more there's more vowels in
English. Okay. Yes, there are more vowels in English. We didn't talk about the vowels in English because I thought this would be a little bit of, you know, a bit too much. But actually, there are a lot of vowels in English. And across different varieties of English, so between New Zealand English, American English, Australian English, British English. Yeah, there you go. There are some differences in the consonants, like, for example, the water and the ba and so on. But most of the differences are in the vowels. So you can tell an Australian because they say, they don't say fish and chips, they say fish and chips. Yeah. And Sydney, we don't say that. That's right, that's right. And, you know, and all of those things. The vowels are the most fluid and changeable parts of a language phonology. So they change through time, and we'll have a look at, they change over time, and there are also some changes in vowels that are happening right now in New Zealand English. Young people say some vowels differently from the way we say them or used to say them. But also they change regionally. So Americans' vowels are very different from New Zealand vowels, different again from Australian vowels and so on. Let's carry on. Okay, so, oh, that's a typo there. Sorry, excuse my typo. So once we have sounds worked out, then, how are we doing for time? How are we doing for time, Stuart, you know? We're about halfway through?
A bit more, yeah.
Okay, good, okay. Then we have, so if we put the sounds together, we get, what do we get? We get words, okay? And as English speakers, we tend to think of words as these little bricks of meanings, right? So a word is usually a person or a thing. I say house, you hear it, you think of the structure with the building and the doors and house, one word, one thing, okay, that's it. So that's pretty self-contained. And English is like that because English is an isolating language. So it doesn't like to put a lot of meaning into just one word. Some words pack a little bit more meaning. So if I say houses, for example, the S at the end of houses tells you that there's more than one. So there are two meanings in that word. There is the house, and then there is the plural that tells you there is more than one house. That's about as much information as English puts into a word. Now, some languages are really different. So this is from Turkish. Okay, so this is one word. In this word, there are four distinct bits of meaning. So there is house, and then there is a plural, so you know that there are more than one house. And then there is the possessive your, and then there is a preposition from. So the whole word includes from your houses. So that's four bits of meaning. Okay, so that this language is called agglutinative, like glue, like to put things together, glue them together, lots of meaning in just one word. Now have a look at that one. Now this is Inuktitut, and it's an Arctic language. It's of the family of the Inuit languages. This is one word, and this word has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 packets of meaning into it. This word means I can't hear very well. Now, that's not just four bits of meaning. That's our entire sentence. It includes a subject, a verb with a modal verb, and adverbs. So that's a whole sentence all together, right? So some languages are like that. These are really difficult languages to learn, particularly for English speakers, where that quality of putting a lot of meaning together in a word is absent. So the more different the language is from the language that you start with, the more difficulty you will have in learning it. But infants that were born into this community, they have absolutely no trouble learning it. They learn it by five, they can speak it, and by 10, they are masters. That's a control that you as an English speaker will never get in your lifetime. So, and the most fascinating thing is that no one teaches them. They just work it out. The brain of an infant is incredible. We'll come back to that in a minute. When you look at what meanings we find secretly stashed into words or into sentences, even in English, we find that these packets of meaning that we find tend to always be the same. So languages express them differently, sometimes with their own individual words and sometimes with little bits of words that are glued together into longer words. But the bits themselves, the meaning of those, tend to be universal across languages. And that tells you something really fascinating, not just about languages, but about people, about how our brain works, the kind of things that humans are focusing on all the time. And these things are the secret universal, the semantic universals, which are also cognitive universals, are listed here. So particularly humans are interested in who's doing, who is the doer, who is the subject, the agent, who is doing it. And they're interested in what's going on, so what are they doing, the verb, okay? So someone is doing something, what are they doing? We really like those two things. And then if they're doing something on something or to someone else, we want to know who is the receiver, okay? So you have the subject, the verb, and the object. Those are the three things that languages really, really like. You find them in just about every language in the world, which means that they are in our mind as humans. They're universals. And then there are other things. The where, the how, the why, and the other bits and pieces like negatives. So I do something, I don't do something. We like that positive-negative polarity as well. So that tells you something about the universality of language, which has to do with the universality of how our mind works. The fact that if someone came in running through that door and said, "He did it again," most of us would turn around and the question in our mind would be, well, who did what? Okay, so these are kind of survival things. They are survival skills that you have in your brain. The priority that you give to certain bits of information over other bits because it can save your life. And those are agent, action, patient, and then in a different family of priority, all the other things. Why, where, how, and so on. And so what happens is that languages are just different ways to encode the same things. So you have these universal bits of meanings, and then you have lots of other meaning. And what languages do, the way they differ from each other, is just how they encode them. And so you don't really need to learn any content. The content is already there. You just have to learn a different way of expressing it if you're learning a second language. Once you start thinking about words, there's a word that comes up very often, which is lexicon. And I notice with my students in particular, lexicon is quite often used interchangeably with vocabulary. And it's not. So here's another secret from a linguist. Don't use lexicon. That's what I am actually correcting your grammar here. So don't use lexicon for vocabulary. They're actually two different things. Vocabulary is the range of words that exist in a language. You can capture the vocabulary of a language and print it, and that's called a dictionary. It exists there independently from you, me, or anybody. It's there. It's the list of all the words of a language. The lexicon is very personal. We all each have our own lexicon in our mind. The lexicon is the mental vocabulary. Each speaker has a different system in their mind to store and access the language that they use every day. So the lexicon is the entire mental system of word knowledge that we each have. And it's not just words, but it's words and their meanings and how they are articulated and how they're written down if we know how to write the language. And also, most importantly, the relationships between each individual word. And I'll show you. And how do we store, how does the lexicon work in the brain? Well, we know for a fact that there are two main ways in which we store words in our brain. Three things we know. One, we store them as webs, as networks. We don't store them as lists like the dictionary does. In our mind, words are connected through web-like systems, much like the ones that you have on the diagram. And the connections are mostly through sound. So words that sound the same or have sound similarities, they tend to be connected with each other. It's like you store them in the same drawer. Okay, so you have a drawer for cat, hat, rat, mat. Okay, they're all kind of stored at the same. They're all very, very heavy connections between them, very dense. But if you say library, it's in a completely different drawer. So they're stored by sound. And they're also stored by meaning. And although storing by sound tends to be more universal, like you're likely to have a mat, rat, cat, mat drawer like mine. We all kind of have that. But then we have very, very idiosyncratic personal storage devices by meaning. And this is why therapists sometimes get you to do word associations, right? Because they say a word, and you say the word that you think when you hear that word, and that could be the same word that I would say, or it could be something completely different. Because that particular word in your brain is surrounded by a web of meaning that is just true to you, depending on who you are, where you grew up, the experiences that you've had, your first, second, third language, what you had for breakfast, what you heard on the news last night, and all of those things. So the lexicon is not the vocabulary. The lexicon is the system that you have in your mind, and it's just yours. No two people have the same lexicon. Those webs are very, very, very personal. Yes? And that's what happens when people have traumatic events. They have accidents where they might hurt their head, and some parts of their brain might be compromised. In some of those cases, the connections between the words, those webs of meaning, they get compromised. So they might have trouble remembering words or connecting different words or speaking. That's called aphasia. And it happens when those networks are disrupted by trauma or by disease. Okay. We also have lots more words in our brain that we use. So that's the passive lexicon. You know lots and lots and lots of words, and some words you actually never use. Right? That's right. And your lexicon is not just personal to you. tailored by and shaped by your experience, but it's also shaped by your culture. So by the users of language that you hear, that you're exposed to every day, your community, how that word exists in your community. And so when you look at languages and you look at different languages, the different lexicon, sorry, the different vocabularies, the different languages, what you find is that although each language has the potential to express any meaning, some languages have vocabularies that are particularly rich in particular areas of life and experience. And those areas tend to be specific to each culture. So each language tends to have more words for the things that are really important to the speakers of that language. And that is true of things that are important environmentally. So, for example, some of the languages of the Arctic, in Inuit and Sami, there are a lot of words for things that people experience every day in many different forms. So we all know that the Inuit have so many words for snow, whereas really English only has one word for snow. I mean, you can qualify, you know, it's melting snow, it's soft snow, it's hard snow and so on, but the word for snow is always the same. Inuit has a range of words for snow. Why? Because it's important. For a start, it's always there. And then it's important that you know the different types of snow so that you can walk on it and not die, so that you can fish through it and, you know, and support your family, so that you don't slide and hit your head and hurt yourself. Sami has more than 180 words for reindeer. That's because they only eat reindeer, or just about. So very important for their livelihood and more likely to be differentiated in the vocabulary. And we all know about the word for family in Te Reo Māori, which is not really the word for family. They're two different, family and whānau, two different things. They kind of mean the same, but they have very different boundaries and very different connotations, right? And one is not the same as the other. So languages are also shaped not by what's important locally to the community that speak them, but also by their particular understanding of the world, by their experience of the world. If your experience of family tends to be that of the nuclear family, which is, you know, and your friends all had the same nuclear family and it's just the same kind of family repeated over and over, you would have this word for family, and in your mind, family would mean mum, dad, maybe up to three kids, maybe a dog, maybe one or two cars, that's just about it. That's the family in your lexicon. But whānau is different. The experience of family is different in that community. It's much broader, it's much wider. It doesn't include just more people, but also the relationships between the people are different. The roles across the generations are different. The gender roles are different. The responsibilities are different. So the idea of family and the idea of whānau are very, very different. We tend to equate them in the mind of people. Okay, that's the translation of that, but it's not. Different cultures understand things differently. And so there are some other examples over there. So it's not just what's useful, what's always there. It's not just what's important and for livelihood. Vocabulary is also shaped by experience and cultural values and cultural understanding.
But then you have your family of languages.
Yes, we'll get to that in a minute. So some of the people that have talked about how language is relates to how we understand the world are these two gentlemen here. They're two linguists, Sapir and Benjamin Wolf. So it was Benjamin Wolf that said, "The world is presented in a kaleidoscopic flux of impression which has to be organized by our minds. And this means largely by the linguistic systems in our mind. They were interested in this idea that if you grew up with language, right? And let's say you only have one language from birth. Your language is shaped by your culture, shaped by the values in your culture, is shaped by the understandings of your culture. You don't have words for things that you've never experienced. You have a lot of words for things that you experience every day. There is a sense of priority of values that's encoded in your language. In a way, language is the filter. Imagine a pair of glasses. It's the filter through which you understand the world. The world exists out there as a continuous stream of meaning, data that comes at you, colors, shape, people, and so on. How do you make sense of it? Well, the idea of linguistic determinism, or the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which was a very early hypothesis of the relationship between language and the brain, the language and thought, says that you're kind of trapped, you know, you kind of run the risk to be trapped in your own language, because language is how you understand the world, and if you only have one language, you only have one way to understand the world, the way of your colleagues, you know, speakers of the same language. And so, is it true? Are we at the mercy of our own language? And through the years, a lot of people have really looked into this fascinating idea, and there's lots of research around it. And these days, the belief is that there is some truth to the theory. Language does shape the way we see the world, but it's much more subtle, and it includes much more gray areas than the theory allowed, the original version of the theory allowed for. So I'm going to show you a little video. It's only a few minutes. It's a video that was made in Africa by a linguist that was interested in finding out how the vocabulary of your language shapes the way you view the world in something really, really essential, in colors. So in English, we have a certain amount of words for colors. We all know them. But other languages have different systems of colors. Some languages have only 5 words for colors. Some languages have only 4. Some languages have more, and so on. So how having the vocabulary for colors, does that shape the way we see colors? So that was the question, and so I'm going to show you some of that research. Okay, so the original theory, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which is we are at the mercy of our language and what our language allows us to perceive and to think, it is true in some way. We do have a bias. Our language drives us to see and understand the world in a particular way. But it's not the case that we can't break free. For a start, we can learn other languages, and by learning other languages, we learn other systems, other frameworks, other ways of seeing the world. And also, we can think without language. It's not true. People think that they always, you know, quite often that's a word, that's a question that I'm asked quite often is, in which language do you think? We don't always just think in words. We don't always just think in language. So there is a level of our understanding and thinking and reasoning, which is, it's before language, pre-linguistic. So so language does shape the way we see our world, but it doesn't determine it. And so the hypothesis got softened from linguistic determinism to linguistic relativity. And those are the tenets of the theory. Language does shape thought. We do see the world through the lens of our language, and different languages does carve up reality differently. And also how we speak influences how we perceive reason and behave. And speaking differently means thinking differently. And that's one of the arguments for multilingualism. The more languages you can speak, the more open your mind is, the more perspectives you have access to, the more solutions you potentially have for the problems of being a human being. And so I'm going to stop here. I do have many more slides, and I would like to perhaps, after we take a little break, the gentleman at the back mentioned language families, and I do have something on language families as well, so if you're interested, I can show you the slides later on. But let's take a little break, and then when we come back, we can have some questions and we can have a bit of a discussion, if you want.
Okay, and I do know, yes, you've almost enough for two talks here.
Yeah.
Actually, it's interesting, your whole question of words. In doing research, if you do quantitative research, there's issues of aggregation of data into groups. And they're all approximations because you're assuming homogeneity within the group and heterogeneity differences across groups. But words themselves, as you saw with colours, they are aggregating, and you've got a whole range of greens and blues and so on. We just have certain words, and the different languages have different words, different classifications. So you are actually approximating the real world in different ways with different languages.